It happened so rarely that Ehuru was summoned to perform his duty. Oh, the commissions were summonings in their way, submitted through intercessors, assessed by committee, and sanctified with prayer before a gatherer ever saw them. So distant that way. A direct summons was better. Then the gathering could be performed by daylight, treasured, celebrated. The tithe-bearer could pass into eternal joy with family and friends near to witness the wonder and bid farewell. But so few truly believed in Hananja's blessing, or welcomed it as they should. All the procedure, all the stealth had been designed for them, those of weak faith or none at all. Even now Ehuru noted the ones who drew away as he walked through the streets in his formal gatherer's robe, face hooded, the black oasis rose visible on his shoulder. It saddened Ehuru that so many of Hananja's citizens feared her greatest gift. But perhaps that, too, was her will. The greatest mysteries of life, or death, were always frightening, but no less marvelous for that. In the merchant quarter, lovely, sprawling houses surrounded him. He reached the one he sought, and found its inhabitants waiting, formally dressed and solemn, flanking the open door in twin rows to signal that the way was clear. A tall, pale-skinned elder was the master of the house. He bowed deeply as Ehuru passed, but not before Ehuru caught his eyes and read the faith there. Here was one at least who did not begrudge the goddess her due. But for now his duty was to another. Ehuru said nothing as he passed the old man and entered the dwelling. She would be in the servant quarters. He stepped through a hanging and discovered a vast courtyard where a lesser house's atrium would be. Several tiny cottages clustered here. Some showed personal touches, a flower garden in front of this one, inexpert glyphs decorating the walls of that. He examined each house in turn, contemplating what he'd fathomed of the tithe-bearer from her note. It had been brief, using the blocky pictorials of a semi-literate rather than the more elegant hieratics taught to higher castes. Simple language, a simple request, written inexpertly but with care. His eyes settled on the nearest of the cottages. Conservatively decorated, comfortable in appearance, linked to the house by a neat path of river stones. Yes, this would be the one. As Ehuru pushed open the front hanging, the smell hit him. Old blood, feces, infection. Neither the herbalist's incense nor the sachets of dried flowers hanging from the ceiling could mask the stench. There were few diseases that magic could not heal, but those were always the worst. The cottage was little more than a single large room. A tiny altar stood in one corner. A fire pit took up another. The far end of the room was dominated by a small pallet, on which lay a silent, shuddering form, the tithe-bearer. But she was not alone. A boy-child who could have seen no more than 6 floods, 7 at the most, knelt beside the pallet. Beside him were bowls, wadded cloths, a plate that held some sort of herbal paste, and the incense brazier. A child so young, nursing his mother as she lay dying. Then the child turned and gazed at him with eyes like desert jasper gone dull with age, and Ehuru experienced a sudden flutter of intuition. The shaky, crude pictorials of the note, not an adult's hand at all. "Are you the gatherer?" the boy asked. His voice was very soft. "Yes." The child nodded. "She stopped talking this morning." He turned back to the woman and laid his small hand on her trembling one. "She's been waiting for you." After a moment's contemplation, Ehuru stepped forward and knelt beside the boy. The woman was awake, but so far gone with pain that Ehuru marveled at her silence. The disease was a cruel one that he had seen before, infecting the bowels, so that the victim's own body poisoned itself trying to fight the invader, too late by the time the first symptoms appeared. She would have been passing blood for days, unable to draw nourishment from food, burning with fever even as she took chill from shock. Ehuru had heard the pain described as if some animal nested within the victim's gut and sought to chew its way out. Her eyes were fixed on the ceiling. Ehuru passed a hand before her face, but they flickered only a little. He sighed and reached up to lower his hood, then paused as he considered the boy's presence. The child had sent for him, but probably on his mother's request. Could a child so young comprehend the blessing that a gatherer brought? Yet as he looked again into the child's ancient, soul-weary eyes, he knew this one could. So he lowered his hood and put a hand on the child's shoulder, squeezing gently for a moment before returning his attention to the woman. "I am Ehuru, named Ensha in dreams. I come as summoned to deliver you from the pains of waking into the peace of dream. Will you accept Hananja's blessing?" No response, save a faint, racking shudder from the woman. "She accepts," the boy whispered. After a moment, Ehuru nodded. So he stroked her eyelids shut and sent her to sleep, and crafted a dream that brought her pleasure in place of torment. When he opened his eyes to observe her last breath, her cheeks glistened with tears, and her face was rapt with joy. He lifted the sheet to arrange her and to set his mark on her breast. It was beautiful against her unblemished red-brown skin. He so rarely gathered women, and this was a young one at that. "Thank you," the boy whispered. Ehuru focused on him, contemplating. "Where is your father?" The boy only shook his head. He was servant caste. Any man who'd felt a passing fancy for his mother could have sired him. No relatives would be willing or able to support him. The master of the house might keep him, or release him to find a new master if he could. Then his life would continue in years of endless, mindless toil. He held out a hand to the child. "Does it pain you?" The boy's eyes lifted slowly. "Your heart." "Oh." "Yes, gatherer." Ehuru nodded. "I'm no sharer, but I have your mother's peace within me. If anyone has the right to it, you do. Give me your hand." The child took his hand, with no hesitation or fear, Ehuru noted, pleased. So he pulled the boy into his arms and held him, and shared with him an instant of the bliss that his mother would now know for eternity. A bit of cautery, no more than that. Dream blood might soothe wounds of the heart, but it was never right to take the pain away completely. The child went limp in his arms and began to weep, and Ehuru smiled. A step behind him. He rose and turned with the child in his arms, and saw the master standing at the threshold of the cottage. The rest of the family and servants hovered behind him, peering in. "Gatherer?" "If you have no objection, Sejong's elder, I'll take this child back to the Hedawa with me." The elder's eyebrows rose. "I have no objection, gatherer, but are you certain? He's only a child, too young yet to be much use as a servant." "Only a child, and only a servant, but able to accept death and understand its blessing." Ehuru shifted the child to lean him against one shoulder, and smiled as thin arms encircled his neck. As a gatherer, he had never expected nor wanted sons. In spite of this, he stroked the boy's back, and for just a moment wondered if this was how it felt to have one. "He will serve the goddess now," he said. And then he left with the boy safe in his arms, a mother's dream blood warm inside him, and tears of love drying against his skin. Ehuru watched as Sharer Manian fingers on Najiri's closed lids, sighed and opened his eyes. You were right to share peace with him immediately. His umbilike was a hair from snapping. The sharer took his hands from the boy. He'll recover with no permanent harm. Physically, at least. Ehuru sent a prayer of thanks to the goddess. The creature was on him for only a breath. Gatherings are never so quick. You can't call this a gathering. Munian scowled so fiercely that his thin, fine brows almost met in the middle of his forehead. It's too obscene for that. The humor was stripped with such speed and force that it left great rents in his mind. I've healed them, but there will be scars. Ehuru ached in silent misery, lowering his eyes to the alcove floor. My fault. Don't you dare blame yourself. Though if I hadn't seen the evidence with my own eyes, I would never have believed it. Gods! A reaper! He shook his head as he got to his feet to stretch, eyeing Ehuru sidelong. I would have said the madness had taken you. I would have said the same before tonight, Ehuru replied. He lifted a hand to one temple to massage the dull ache there. But visions don't leave bruises or bodies. Munian frowned, stepping closer and pushing Ehuru's hand away. Ehuru felt the sharer's cooler fingers press against his temple, followed by the more subtle touch of another soul against his own. You spent your last reserve giving peace to the boy, and took no tithe tonight. No. The sharer's lips twitched, probably in disapproval. You need an infusion, then. I'll wake Inest. He has enough left to share with you, and it's almost time for his duty shift anyhow. Ehuru hesitated. I would prefer to face the Pranje. Now, rather than at my usual time. Munian scowled. You've been foolish about this long enough, Ehuru. You've served more than enough penance. That is for Hananja to say, not you. Ehuru folded his arms and fixed his gaze on Najiri, feeling more certain of his decision as he did so. I tried to gather last night, and circumstances demanded an abeyance. Then I tried to prevent a murder and failed. A child is dead, her soul banished to torment. Her body lies in an alley like trash, and now my apprentice has been harmed as well. Does that sound as though Hananja still wants me to work, Munian? It sounds like you're seeing omens around every corner. Ehuru pointed a finger at Najiri's prone form. The boy still slept, but was beginning to breathe faster as he recovered. There lies an omen. What do you think it means? Munian flinched at his sharpness, and with an effort Ehuru restrained his anger before it could alarm the sharer further. More calmly, he said, Do you believe it was all a vision? Munian rolled his eyes. No, obviously something happened to Najiri. But your reserves are low enough to be problematic, Ehuru. You cannot deny. I don't want to deny it. I welcome it. I'll go into seclusion now if you think I should, but I won't ignore this coincidence, if that it is. I think she calls me to commune with her, Munian. I am her servant. I must obey. And your apprentice? Munian gestured toward Najiri, his own anger bordering on the unpeaceful. If you undergo the Pranje now, and she tells you to offer the final tithe, he'll be left alone. Santai has trouble mustering enough simple human compassion to comfort his tithe-bearers, much less anyone else. Rabana, then. Munian scowled in exasperation and poked Ehuru in the chest with a finger. You, stubborn fool, you're the one the boy is in love with. Ehuru flinched at Munian's bluntness, but then Munian had always been too blunt, willing to say things no gatherer would put to words. Most sharers wouldn't have either. That was just Munian's way. It's a good thing. Only love can heal scars like his. And yours, if you ever decide to do more than just let them fester. Ahuru took an involuntary step back, unbalanced by more than the jab. Najiri chose that moment, conveniently, to stir. Throwing a last glare at Ahuru, Manian went to the boy's pallet and knelt, lifting one of his eyelids to peer within. Pursing his lips as he gauged something only a sharer could fathom, Manian then leaned down and whispered in the boy's ear. Najiri's eyelids flicked open, blank and disoriented, and then he bucked, throwing Manian off and rolling away. He backed himself against the alcove wall in a crouch, eyes wild, before the sharer could do more than gasp out a swift oath and reach after him. Ahuru quickly caught Manian's hand. Sentinel training functioned in concert with instinct. In this state, the boy might break the sharer's arm. Pushing Manian back, he crouched low so as to seem less threatening. Peace, Najiri. The danger has passed. It took several breaths for sense to flow back into the boy's eyes. When it did, he shut them again and sagged against the wall. Brother. Ahuru crept closer. Here. The demon's gone. We've come home to the Hedwa, and you're safe in Hananja's own hall. See? He got close enough to reach out and touch Najiri's cheek with his fingertips. The boy's eyes opened, and for a moment Ahuru was thrown 10 years back in time. Desert Jasper. Then the vision passed. Yes, Najiri whispered. I see you, brother. Beyond them, Manian dared to take a step closer. How do you feel, gatherer apprentice? Najiri sighed and shifted to sit on his knees. Ahuru took his hand as a Pranje attendant would have to help him focus. Like a 40 of children dance a prayer inside my skull, Sharer Manian, with every one of them wearing thick, heavy sandals. Forgive my irreverence. Manian let out a chuckle, breathy with relief. Under the circumstances, I'll gladly forgive you, apprentice. Do you remember what happened? The boy's face grew momentarily still. I remember. An alley. No, a darker place. There were creatures. I saw them breathing. Abruptly, he shook his head. I remember nothing more. The boy's furrowed brow and tight lips said otherwise, but Ahuru did not press, and neither did Manian. Instead, the sharer touched his other hand. Your memory may return in time. For now, you need rest. Sharers, Ahuru said, always putting body before soul. He got to his feet, pulling the boy up with him. Najiri swayed a bit, but then steadied. The threat to the people is more important than our comfort, Manian. We'll both rest after we've made our report. The boy focused on him, nodded agreement. Manian rolled his eyes. Gatherers, too stubborn for sanity, he mimicked Ahuru's voice. Very well. I'll send an acolyte to wake the superior. No need, Manian. They turned. The superior stood in the doorway of the healing alcove, flanked by Dinyeru, a senior sentinel. A hastily donned robe draped the superior's shoulders, but his eyes were clear and hard. Two more warriors stood beyond him, Ahuru noticed abruptly. Strangers, wearing the red and gold of the Sunset Guard. Gatherer, the superior said quietly, present yourself for the judgment of the Hedwa. Najiri gasped. Ahuru stared back at the superior, uncomprehending. Manian recovered first. Superior, you cannot believe that Ahuru... I believe many things, Manian. The superior stepped aside. Dinyeru and the two strangers came into the alcove. In Dinyeru's hands was an odd contraption, two long, hinged cylinders, sealed together down the length, each ending in a round bulb. Manacles, meant to enclose the forearms and force the hands into closed fists, a rogue's yoke. Ahuru had seen the device many times as a child, while cleaning items in the Hedwa's archival vault. It had never been used in his lifetime. I believe in the beneficence of our goddess, the superior continued. I believe in the honor and judgment of our prince. Therefore, I must believe it when his guardsmen come to tell me that a child was murdered in the city last night. A companion of the Kisawati ambassador, Sunandi J. Kalawe. Your commission, Ehuru, was she not? Ehuru, shocked, made several attempts to speak before his voice worked. Yes, that north-blooded youngster. Yes, her body, the child's body, showed terrible desecration, Ehuru, of soul as well as flesh. It was found in an alleyway. The superior's voice never rose, but his words grew sharp as blades. What have you done with the Kisawati woman's body, gatherer? Ehuru stared at him. Done? There was no body. I declared an abeyance until I could discuss the matter with you. No, there's no body. Her bedchamber is disordered by the signs of struggle. A weapon was found, but she is gone. The superior shook his head then, sorrow eclipsing anger in his face. It's clear the madness hasn't taken you fully, Ehuru, or you would have been unable to stop yourself from killing your apprentice tonight. I thank the goddess for that. Because of it, I cannot cast you out. Some part of you is still our black rose. All of him, superior. Menean stepped forward. I've examined this man. His reserves are gone, true. He may be afflicted by the early symptoms, but there's none of the spirit-wide corruption you're accusing him of. For the dreamer's sake, he's empty, superior. If he had taken a child and a woman and then attacked Najiri, he wouldn't be. The woman was alive when we left, Najiri said, stepping closer to Ehuru. His tone bordered on disrespectful, Ehuru noted through a haze. He would have to take the boy to task for that. She said she was leaving town, she and her girl. She feared an assassin would be sent to kill her for her secrets. That may be, the superior said, though he sounded less than convinced to Ehuru's ears. An assay of truth will determine the fullness of it. In the meantime, the prince demands that the threat to his city be subdued. Behind him, Najiri was compounding his disrespect, speaking with unseemly loudness. The creature that killed the child was not Ehuru brother. I saw it. It touched me, and... He faltered, took a shaky breath. It was not my mentor. Ehuru brother fought the creature off me, saved me. It was someone else. Something else. No other gatherers went out last night, Najiri. The superior had regained control of himself. His voice was inflectionless. Santai and Robina had a much-deserved night off. The girl-child died in obvious agony, but no fatal wounds had been inflicted on her before death. That's because a reaper... That is a myth, apprentice, said the superior. Najiri flinched into resentful silence. A myth told around campfires to make the desert nights pass. A rogue gatherer has no special power or invincibility. He is nothing more than a pathetic creature, consumed by his own weakness, who may have to be put down for the safety of all. Then where are Ehuru's path brothers? Menean gestured sharply at the curtain and the Hedua beyond. Why these strangers, unsworn, untrained? We have always taken care of our own. Because the prince demands it. Both Najiri and Menean flinched back from the superior's flare of temper. Ehuru barely noticed. Too much of him had gone numb. From the corner of his eye, he saw the superior pause, invisibly struggle for calm. Some things are beyond even the Hedua's discipline, the superior said at last, and this time Ehuru heard an odd tightness in his voice, as if the words half choked him coming out. Ehuru will be held in Yanya Ion. We must consider what is best for all Gujara, not just for the Hetawa. He gestured and Dinyeru came forward. Forgive me, Gatherer. Dinyeru raised the yoke, holding it so Eru could thrust his hands into the sleeves. The sentinel's expression was sorrowful, but determined. Not even a gatherer could best a sentinel in combat. Silence fell. Eru closed his eyes. I am still her servant, he whispered, and thrust his arms forward into the yoke. Cold metal embraced them. He fisted his hands and grimaced as the straps along the sleeves were tightened, pulling his forearms together into an uncomfortably awkward position. A metal brace was snapped into place across his wrists, locking them together. Then new hands took his upper arms, the hands of strangers, gripping him without love, and he was pulled along with them out of the Hetawa. Chapter 12. At the mouth of the river, which he named for the blood of Hananja, Enenru built a city. Wisdom. What do you mean Lin hasn't arrived yet? Sunandi demanded. Saya, J. Kalawe, I mean she hasn't come. Etisero eyed Sunandi in mild surprise. I haven't seen that straw-haired rascal since your delegation passed through a season ago, when you first came to the city. I would have remembered the girl. She nicked my purse the last time she was here. And gave it back? Etisero shrugged good-naturedly. My people part fools from their funds all the time. Our children play games to learn the trade. They don't usually put the mark on me, though. And even more rarely do they manage to score. He smiled. I could make a fine trade wife of that girl if you sold her to me. Alas, my father decided long ago that Lin and I should learn to part fools from their secrets instead. Shame for both of you. There's no money in spying. Sunandi shook her head in amusement, recognizing Etisero's effort to put her at ease. Dawn had broken nearly an hour ago, and she'd spent the 2 hours before that in harrowing flight through the corridors of Yanya Iyan and the streets of Gujara. But here, in the Unbelievers' district, as the guest of a wealthy Bromarte, she could rest safely hidden in the sprawling community beyond Gujara's walls. The district had grown over the centuries to house foreign merchants and other opportunists who were eager to profit from Gujara's wealth, but unwilling or unable for reasons of their own faith to submit to Hananja's law. Outside, the streets were thick with people eager to get their business done before the full heat of the day struck. Sunandi observed them for a few moments, momentarily surprised by how odd their bustling hurry seemed after the 2 months she'd spent in the city. Gujarin rarely hurried. Well, Kisawati-reared spy girls were supposed to hurry, and it troubled Sunandi that Lin had not yet arrived at Etisero's. She'd had a good hour's start on Sunandi, and that was more than enough time for her to have talked her way past a gate or hired a ferryman. Then again, I had trouble getting out of the city, Sunandi said, pulling the curtain shut. None of my friends were on duty. That ordinarily wouldn't have been a problem. I had enough funds to pay the toll and a bribe, and they knew from my accent that I was a foreigner. But they were more wary than usual. They questioned me closely. Questioned you about what? Who I was, where I was going, why I was leaving at the crack of dawn. I gave them my usual story for unusual circumstances, a Timberland House mistress going to meet with a distributor to arrange an extra shipment. She brushed a hand against the gown she still wore, which was made of fine pleated linen rather than the more practical heka. The pleats emphasized the points of her breasts, which was something that had usually worked in her favor before. Men rarely remembered her face. I looked the part, but they barely believed me. They checked my eyes to make sure I was a Timbaland addict, They wanted to know which house could afford a mistress with such high coloring. Atisaro muttered something in his own language, then returned to Gujarin so that she could understand him.
They're only that keen when they're on the watch for something. What did you say?
That I worked for the most expensive house in the high-caste district.
That I was once an account-keeper in Kiswa before I fell low, which explained the accent.
And thankfully, my eyes were still bloodshot from being woken in the middle of the night by a Decado gatherer and his little killer in training, so they let me through. She sighed and ran a hand over the brief, tight curls of her hair. I think the gods must have granted me more than my share of luck in the last few hours. The clan leader made no reply, and Sunandi was startled to realize he was staring at her, his face even paler than normal.
You saw a gatherer?
I told you someone tried to kill me, though I talked him out of it.
No one talks a gatherer out of killing. At the most, they stay their hands for a few days. Then they come after you again.
She sighed and went over to a bench between two carved plinths. It wasn't padded, a Bromarte custom intended to keep their traders' minds sharp, even when they were at rest. And she winced as she sat down too hard. Too many months living in luxury. I'm becoming as soft as the prince. No, the prince only seemed soft on the surface. Peacock and pleasure hound he might be, but no one soft could play such dangerous, terrible games.
Abeyance, she said at last. That's what the gatherer granted me, while he investigates my story to see if it is true.
Then, my sweet Sunandi, you are a dead woman, Atisaro gazed at her solemnly. She rubbed her face, still sleepy. Perhaps the fool planned to go back to his Hedua and demand the truth from his masters. Hopefully they'll kill him and solve my problem.
If they kill him, another gatherer will be sent. The Hedua always fulfills a commission once judgment has been rendered. They consider it a sacred duty.
Atisaro folded his hands and sighed.
Damn them. I never thought I'd lose anyone to their evil, let alone two in the span of a month.
Don't put me in an urn already, man, she paused, frowning as his words penetrated.
Two?
My cousin. Atisaro leaned his elbows on the desk and sighed.
You met him. Negotiator in Gujara for his wife's clan. Kept an ear to the ground among the merchants and common folk for me. He lived within the city's walls, liked it there, the fool, said it was soothing. But several days ago they found him dead in his bed. The innkeeper said it looked as though he had been gathered. To me it looked more like he'd had a heart seizure or something else painful in his sleep. But those Gujarin can always read a death.
Sunandi frowned at the dark flicker of memory brought on by Atisaro's words. They'd called Kinja's death a heart seizure, too.
I remember the man. Large fellow, he kept telling me how much he liked dark women.
The very one. Charleron. Atisaro shook his head. Only the day before I'd received a letter from him saying he was coming to visit.
We never spoke about clan business, but he shared any interesting gossip that he heard with me. This time he'd heard something important that he wanted to tell me in person. Something about a rift between the Hedua and the sunset.
Sunandi inhaled and stared at him.
Yes, I know. And then he turned up dead. Murdering Gwalo.
He rubbed his eyes with one hand, pausing for a moment to master himself. Bromarte men did not cry in front of women. The Hedua paid for his funeral, hired mourners and a chantress, bought him a lapis-covered urn, put him in their own special vault above the floodline, buried him like a king after they killed him. How I hate this city.
Silence had its own eloquence at times, so Sunandi kept hers. It lasted only for a moment, however, until the house's heavy wooden door, a necessity in this district, and double-locked, banged downstairs. Light, quick feet on the steps told them that Atisaro's young son, Saladronim, had returned from his morning shift as a messenger. The boy came up the steps breathless,
his cheeks flushed pink and eyes bright. He paused only long enough to offer a quick bow to Sanandi before blurting his news.
"Soldiers, father, in the marketplace."
Atisaro frowned. Sanandi rose and went to the window. Behind her, she heard the traitor quizzing Saladronum. The boy's careful recital of details and observations put a momentary smile on her lips. Kinja had not been the only one to see the merits of sharp-witted children, it seemed. Below, in the streets, she saw what the boy meant. Amid the drab earth colors of common folk going about their business, flashes of brighter color stood out. A scattering of warriors and bronze half-torso armor moved through the crowd. Their skirts were a rusty red-orange, and their yellow headcloths swung from side to side, searching. Cold prickled along her spine. Atisaro rose and came to the window beside Sunandi. "That isn't the city guard. I've never seen men wearing those colors before."
"I have," Sunandi said.
She stepped back from the window, crossing her arms over her breasts to stop herself from shivering. "They are the prince's own men, the Sunset Guard. They leave the palace only on his direct orders." Atisaro raised an eyebrow at her. "If you weren't Kisawati, you'd be pale now." She took a deep breath, trying to calm her fluttering heart. "That gatherer was sent to kill me. Perhaps the prince has decided to make certain the job is done properly." Atisaro nodded slowly. Near the desk, Atisaro's son sat cross-legged on the floor, watching both of them avidly. "You'll have to remain here," the traitor said. "No one knows you're in this house. Stay hidden for a few days, and they'll decide that you must have reached the trade roads. They'll move on, and then so can you." She frowned at that.
"No. Kinja's information
has waited since Kinja died 2 seasons ago. Whatever recent discoveries you've made will survive another 4 days' delay. Leaving now means the protectors never get this information, because those men will catch you and kill you. Better late than never, hmm?"
He was right. Sunandi began to pace in an effort to vent her restlessness.
"Very well. But not a 4-day. If what I've learned is true, the prince's plans could spell destruction for us all. Northerner and Southerner, Gujarin and Kiswati, and everyone who trades with either land. Better in time than too late, hmm?"
Atisaro sighed.
"I think the gods of wind and fortune, our women care more about money than politics in the north. I don't know what I'd do if I had to go home to one like you."
Sanandi permitted herself a small smile.
"Fine, then." Atisaro flicked the hangings around the window closed. "How do you want to do it?"
"See if Gahanu's group is in town. I've traveled with them before, and they make the run from Gujarat to Kiswa often at this time of year." She took a deep breath. "That leaves me with only one worry. Lin."
Atisaro saw her face and understood. He went over to his son and put a hand on the boy's shoulder. "Fetch refreshments for our guest. Figs and almonds if we have them. Kanpo nut and cheese if we don't." The boy jumped up and went downstairs, and Atisaro eyed Sunandi. "You should build your strength for the journey. The desert is hard on the weak." His words chafed no less, she decided. For all that, they were true. So she seated herself on the hard bench and ate when Saladronum brought her food, and tried her best to invent new and scathing scolds to heap upon Lin when she finally arrived. Chapter 13. A gatherer shall neither marry nor acquire property. He shall sully not his body with drug, sex, or other impairment, nor his soul with personal attachments, beyond those of faith and brotherhood. He is the right hand of Hananja, and to her he belongs wholly. Law. The din of the late morning market floated in through the narrow cell window in a babble of voices, clanging objects and the clucks and bleats of animals. There was comfort in it, despite the cacophony, for it was the sound of the city's daily routine. How could Hananja not be pleased by the order and prosperity of her people? Ehuru smiled to himself as he knelt in the light and listened. Then, from behind, the sound of his cell door's lock jarred the steady drone of the market. Ehuru glanced around, curious. The men in the guard station had been solicitous toward him thus far, their ingrained respect for gatherers still strong, despite the ignominy of his circumstances. They had not disturbed him since he'd been brought to the station, but now three men stepped within, pausing until the door shut again behind them. Two were Sunset guardsmen who had brought him to the station. They took up positions on either side of the door, hands resting on knife hilts. The third man was a bearded stranger in the garb of a mid-castman, an artisan, Ehuru guessed, by the loose smock and headcloth the man wore. And yet, Ehuru narrowed his eyes, frowning at an odd sense of familiarity about the man's build and carriage.
"Don't you recognize me, Ehuru? I do this to fool the commoners when I walk among them, but I never imagined it would fool you as well." The artisan stepped into the patch of light, smiling with lazy and familiar amusement.
Ehuru caught his breath. "An Inket?" The prince raised both eyebrows, smile widening.
"I haven't heard that name in years. Mind you, I'm supposed to have you killed for uttering it."
He moved past Ehuru to the narrow shelf that served as the cell's bed, and seated himself with regal grace.
"But I think we can ignore protocol under the circumstances."
As the shock faded, Ehuru composed himself and shifted to face the prince. As best he could, for the rogue's yoke interfered with movement, he lifted his arms in manuflection and spoke in Sua.
"Please forgive me, my prince. I meant no disrespect."
"You need not retreat behind formality either," the prince replied in kind, then switched back to Gujarin so they could speak casually.
"I've yearned to speak with you in private for years, Ehuru. I'll admit this is unfair, doing this when you're effectively captive, but you refused all of my invitations."
"I am a mere servant of Hananja. You are the bringer of night, herald of dreams, her consort-to-be in Inakarek. It is not the place of a servant to dine at the master's table."
"It isn't the place of a servant to avoid the master either," the prince retorted, then sighed.
"No, this isn't how I wanted it. We're here now, Ehuru. Can't we be brothers again, at least for a few moments?"
Ehuru kept his eyes on the floor, though he finally lowered his arms and dispensed with Sua as well.
"Can a bird return to its egg? You call me brother, but we have not been that for decades. And perhaps..."
He bit the words back, closing his eyes as memories assailed him with sudden, painful force. The scent of blood, like metal on the tongue, his mother's mortal gasp. He could almost see the rose marble walls of Kaitian around him. Vision, he told himself, and grimly refocused his mind on the present.
"And perhaps we never were brothers?" the prince asked.
His voice was soft and sober in the dim chamber.
"So I was right. You don't understand. Or forgive."
Ehuru said nothing, and the prince sighed.
"There were those who would have used you and the rest of our siblings to sow chaos throughout Gujara, Ehuru. Think. Your mother was Kisawati Shuna, from an old and well-connected lineage. Would her son not have been more palatable to the nobles than the son of a common-born dancer as prince? Even a daughter from a good lineage could have been used to foment unrest, for Gujara has had female princes in its past. I did what was necessary for peace, though I'd never intended for our mothers to suffer. They were supposed to be set free, not killed." He sighed heavily.
That was an error, and the men who committed it were punished. The vision was gone, but in its place Ahuru discovered a flicker of anger, swiftly growing. He fought to keep it banked and his eyes on the floor. "Death is always difficult to control," he said very softly. "I live that truth every night."
"Then perhaps things would have gone better if I'd had a gatherer's discipline."
He paused, gazing steadily at Ahuru.
"I kept expecting you to come for me, you realize. As soon as I heard you'd been chosen as the next gatherer apprentice, I thought, now I will face justice for my crimes. But you never came."
Ahuru forced himself to shrug. "Heirs have assassinated their way to the Oriole since Gujara began. Even the Hetewa accepts the cruelty that is necessary to gain and keep power. So long as a prince uses it to maintain peace from there on. Over time, my brothers," he put the faintest emphasis on the word, "have helped me to understand this." The prince made a sound of disgust, which startled Ahuru into looking up at him. "The Hetewa. You truly have become theirs, Ahuru. How they must love having another of our lineage in their thrall." The anger grew by another measure, and Ahuru discarded protocol.
"Explain."
"Ah, so I've offended you.
But I won't ask your pardon, my brother, for I am unrepentant in my hatred of your adoptive family, as should you be."
The prince gestured toward the rogue's yoke. Ahuru flinched. "It was they who unjustly put that on you, after all."
"The superior said you commanded it."
"I commanded your removal, Ahuru, before the superior could end your life.
Not this humiliation."
Abruptly the prince gestured to one of the guardsmen. "Find the key for that monstrosity he's wearing. I can't stand looking at it any longer." The guard snapped a bow, banged a pattern on the door of the chamber, and exited when the door opened. Ahuru's fists, already sweaty and cramped after hours in the yoke, tightened further.
"Explain."
The prince regarded him for a long moment, then said, "There is indeed a reaper in the city, Ahuru. It killed quietly until lately, men in the prison, elders whose deaths could be made to look natural and the like. I've known it for months."
"And you said nothing to the Hetewa?"
"They already knew."
Ahuru's jaw tightened. "I do not believe that."
"Of course you don't. And I have no way to prove my allegations to you. Nevertheless, they have kept the news of this reaper quiet for reasons only the superior and his highest subordinates comprehend. I've been trying to find some means of proving the reaper's existence, to force them to act. But there have been other matters distracting me lately. This Kisawati spy, among many."
Ahuru nodded.
"Then the commission came from you. You sent me to gather her, for political reasons."
"I did, indeed. She threatens this city."
"Why didn't you kill her?"
"Gathering is not assassination."
The prince rolled his eyes. "Have you never questioned your commissions before, Ahuru? The Kisawati woman would not have been the first."
Ahuru caught his breath and stared at the prince, too revolted to respond. In the intervening silence, the guardsman returned. He moved to kneel at Ahuru's side, but the prince abruptly rose from the cot, brushing him aside and taking the key. He knelt in front of Ahuru. The guardsman gasped and immediately removed his front loin drape to lay on the ground for the prince to kneel upon. The prince waved it away, never taking his eyes from Ahuru's.
"Remember that I freed you, brother," the prince whispered, "while your Hetewa locked you away. Remember that much, if nothing else."
Ahuru blinked out of his shock and stared as the prince deftly undid the locks and buckles of the rogue's yoke. He pulled it off Ahuru's arms and threw it into a corner, where it landed with a loud clatter. Ahuru jerked at the noise, then turned his eyes back to Eninket, the prince, with an effort.
"Why?" he asked, meaning many whys. The prince smiled. I can't tell you everything. You wouldn't understand, anyhow, isolated as they've kept you. Suffice it to say that the Hetawa is corrupt. Your brethren are dangerous to you now. I'll do what I can to clear your name and expose their crimes. But you must do something for me in return.
The Hetawa was corrupt. Ehuru shook his head, unable to absorb such a monstrous concept. What?
The Kisawati woman. She cannot be permitted to reach Kiswa, Ehuru, or there will be war. My men believe she is still in the outer city, the Unbelievers' district. Find her. Complete the gathering. Do this, and I will see to it that you can return to the Hetawa in honor instead of shame. By our holy blood, I swear it.
To return to the Hetawa, to regain the order and peace that had been missing from his life for what seemed like ages. Ehuru closed his eyes, aching with silent longing.
The prince smiled and lifted his hands to cup Ehuru's face. I know you'll do what's right, my brother. He kissed Ehuru then, once on each cheek, on the forehead, and on the lips. It was the way Ehuru's father had kissed him during his childhood before the Hetawa, and memories arose at once to buffet him like mountain winds. Then the prince released him, stood, and turned away to rap on the cell door. The guardsmen fell in behind him as the door opened. When they were gone, the door remained open, waiting for Ehuru. Slowly, Ehuru straightened, untied his waist pouch, and poured the contents into one hand. His ornaments gleamed back at him, the Kisawati woman's scored coin among them. Carefully, for his hands shook again, and this time he could not still them, he put all except the coin back into the pouch. Then he got to his feet, moving slowly as an old man, and walked out of the cell.
Chapter 14. By the age of four floods, a Gujarin child should be able to write the pictorials of the family name, count by fours to 40, and recite the details of every dream upon waking. Wisdom. Najiri sat in the stone garden, trying to keep his knuckles from turning white. They would be watching for that. He could give them no cause to doubt his self-control, not if he wanted to be left free and unchaperoned, not if he meant to go and find Ehuru.
"Hiding something again," Santai said.
He stood across from Najiri, near a column of nightstone, just as unyielding.
"You think we cannot guess your plans. You think we cannot smell the fury curling off you like smoke.
Damnation.
Is my anger not understandable, brother?"
Najiri kept his voice calm.
"What surprises me is your lack of it. Does Hananja's peace silence all sense of propriety and justice?"
"We feel the anger, little brother," Rabana said from behind Najiri. A hand came to rest on his shoulder, squeezing gently. "Dream blood silences nothing. It merely softens."
He paused, then said thoughtfully, "Perhaps if you were to share our peace..." Najiri pulled away. He took care to keep the movement smooth and minimal, polite aversion rather than vehement rejection. "I would prefer to find peace on my own."
Rabana sighed and dropped his hand. "The choice is always yours. But please try to remember, little brother, that Ehuru went willingly."
Yes, Najiri saw the scene again in his mind. The shame in the superior's eyes, and the aching grief in Ehuru's. He went because the Hetawa betrayed him, and he could not bear to be among the corrupt any longer.
"You trespass," Santai warned.
Najiri got to his feet and turned to face them, his fists clenched at his sides.
"I speak the truth, Santai brother. I saw the beast that attacked me last night. I suffered its touch.
and the only reason I survived is because Ehuru brother fought it away and gave me his last dream blood. Sharer Minion saw the evidence of this and vouches for Ehuru brother. Even the superior acknowledged that imprisoning our brother was not justice, but the will of Yanya Eon. Politics. He spat out the last word like the poison it was, and was gratified to see Robina grimace in distaste. Santayi's normally impassive expression grew thoughtful, however. Santayi would be the key, Nijiri knew. The dreaming gift had come upon Santayi too young, or so went the rumors among the acolytes. He had no true emotions, though he mimicked them well enough when necessary, and he drew no distinction between the waking world and the vagaries of dream. Neither could be trusted, neither was real in his eyes. It was a disadvantage in gathering, but there were times, like now, perhaps, when Santayi's view of the world made him the most flexible and pragmatic of all the gatherers. Self-interest, not tradition or faith, drove him. If Nijiri could appeal to this, Santayi might prove an unexpected ally. "We do not judge," Robina began. "But we traditionally have some say," Santayi interrupted, "especially in the matter of our own. It is strange that we were not consulted." Nijiri held his breath. "The superior had to make a quick decision," Robina folded his arms and began to pace, and this tension, too, was a sign, Nijiri realized. The superior's decision sat poorly with both his path brothers. If Minion had declared Ehuru a danger, then the superior's quick decision would have been justified, Santayi said. Minion says his mind is yet whole. It is, Nijiri blurted. He shows only the early signs so far, just handshaking and a bit of temper. He realized his error when they both glared at him. Santayi's face somehow became just a touch colder. "The method of any gatherer's communion with the goddess is private, Nijiri," he said. "You will understand that better, and no doubt respect it more, when you've had to face the long night without dreamblood yourself." Nijiri bowed over both his hands in shame. "Forgive me. It's only..." His shoulders and throat tightened. "Goddess, no, not tears, not now. I can't bear this." Robina stopped pacing, his expression strained and grim. "Nor can I." He turned to Santayi. "You understand what this means?" Santayi nodded. "We don't have enough information to make an assessment yet. Therefore, we must acquire more." "Perhaps we should take this to the Council of Paths," Robina said. "Our judgment may be impaired by our closeness to the situation." Santayi looked at him. Robina fell silent. Nijiri frowned at both in confusion. "No," Robina said at last. He turned away, his back stiff, and sighed. "I don't really believe that." Santayi regarded Robina for a moment. Then he turned to Nijiri, his gaze speculative. "How will you find him if you go?" Only Hananja's grace prevented Nijiri from gasping aloud. Instead, he took a deep breath to calm the sudden racing of his heart. "He'll be in one of the guard stations," he said. "Yanya Eon has no dungeon, and the Sunset Guard does not control the prison."
"There are 8 guard stations, apprentice, one for each quadrant of the city, inner and outer."
"I'll have to check them all, Santayi brother. But I think he'll be at one of the inner stations, since they're closer to Yanya Eon. I imagine the guards will want to be in range of quick reinforcements if our brother should somehow break free." Santayi's eyes, gray as stone, probed Nijiri's for several long moments, though what he sought Nijiri could not fathom. Robina stared at Santayi in disbelief. "You cannot mean this, Santayi." "Neither you nor I can go," Santayi said, The city has only 2 working gatherers left. We are needed.
So is Najiri. He must replace Una Une. Bad enough we'll have 1 green gatherer, but if Ehuru is lost, we have to begin training.